Lech Walesa and what's her name? What was her name? Let's see. What was Aquino's first name? Was it Corazon? Corazon was the husband, wasn't it? Aquino, I can't remember. Oh, gosh. Mrs. Aquino, we'll go with that. Mrs. Aquino of the Philippines and Lech Walesa of Poland. If they were, if that was, say, for example, I get run over on the way home, I hope not, but say it happens, and substitute comes in and says, okay, we're taking all essay tests for the rest of the year, and he should have been all the way up to the 1980s and teaching this class, so whether you like it or not, you're taking an essay question about what does Lech Walesa and Mrs. Aquino have in common on the impact of world democracy? Aside from flipping the person off, what would you respond with? That might be your real feeling, but does that bring any common memory together? Well, Corazon Aquino, I think that's her name. I forgot the husband's name, but the husband was an opponent of Marcos in the Philippines for quite some years. He came to America for heart operation, was warned never come back. He came back anyway, was killed deplaning, shot just as he got down to the bottom of the ladder. His wife then took up the struggle to go against Marcos and form a democracy movement, overthrowing the dictatorship of Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines. This is mid-80s. At the same time she was doing this, there was a movement called Solidarity in Poland. It was a union made up of ship workers in Gdansk or Danzig who said that they were sick and tired of putting up with Russian domination of Poland and the communist government in Poland. So at the same time that the Philippines were overthrowing Marcos, the Poland and eventually Hungary and other Eastern European nations were all rejecting Russian rule. And a lot of this was on in the anticipation that Gorbachev would let them go, and he did. So that's why in more recent years this Danzig or Gdansk area is considered the beginning of the end of the communist world. Because once Poland refused and Gorbachev did nothing to discipline those in Poland, and once the fences came down, the Iron Curtain came down between Hungary and Bulgaria and Romania, and people started to migrate west, then these Western nations declared their independence, Ukraine declared their independence, and the whole Russian Empire, the Soviet Empire, fell apart in 1991. Many people say it's Lech Walesa and the Solidarity movement that got started in Gdansk and Danzig. So I thought that might be something that, guess it doesn't. Pretty vivid to me. The reason why is because my wife's Filipino, and I had thought a lot about, instead of being an instructor, being a war correspondent. And when that occurred, I thought to myself, wow, I could be visiting with relatives, etc., and covering all this stuff. But then when I heard the death rate of war correspondents and how high it was, I said, no, I guess teaching school is a little safer. That's why that movement rings a bell to me in the 80s. But to put it back into perspective of World War I and World War II, if you take from what was Germany and give it to Poland and make a Polish corridor to the sea, isn't it going to leave some, if not many, German-speaking people living in that corridor? Austria, which is nearby, what does it have in common with Germany? Same language, same ethnicity, really. And much of the same heritage. You can go all the way back to the Holy Roman Empire. And this area made up of Austria here, and then this area here in Poland, which has German-speaking people. Alsace and Lorraine, the provinces we talked about, have a number of German-speaking people in it. But what am I alluding and hinting to?
Yes,
it would be easy for Hitler to... It's Hitler. Hitler can tell his people, German-speaking people ought to be able to live together. Who used to say this? This is Woodrow Wilson 14 points talk. And so in the 1930s, that is the argument used for building up armaments, annexing and gobbling up lands of the neighbors. And if you wondered why did the German-speaking people let that happen, because they felt it was right. They felt that Germans ought to be able to live together. So that's why the corridor may have been something that was supposed to give Poland access to the sea for better economic conditions. It also created the friction for what started World War II with Germany. Did we already talk about the Allied mandate colonies? Is that where we're at? If we're on Polish, then I guess we have not. The Polish corridor, we haven't come to the Central Power colonies put under Allied mandate control. I think I did already talk about that.
No.
Didn't? Okay. Well, the colonies that come to mind the most quickly is that of the Ottoman Turkish Empire. this is good math for that.
Turkey in World War I loses, so they, like Germany and Austria, are going to be subject to whatever the Allies dish out to them or take from them. We do know that one of the reasons for these nations going to war was to gain strategic advantage by taking over imperial locations. We talked about this at the beginning of the war. But all of this area, just starting to show the evidence of oil and the potential that might come with that, was hotly desired by England and France and Italy. And what was the Turkish Empire, which led to Turkey all across through the Middle East, all across North Africa, all the way to Morocco, now is going to be divided up, taken over in such ways as you don't have to know all these, but like Algeria will become French, Libya will become Italian, Egypt for a short period will be under English control, Palestine will be English, Jordan will be for England, Syria and Lebanon will be French. And these remain, as they're called, mandate colonies all the way until World War II.
During and right after World War II, these colonies will declare their independence from these nations. But this is not what Woodrow Wilson wanted at all. This is the cause of the war. This is the cause of more war in Wilson's mind. But it was the reason for war by the nations that I just mentioned, England, France, and Italy. That's what they wanted in the war, and that's what they got. And that is one of the explanations for how Versailles is closely related to the Palestinian-Israeli situation. I think we talked about that already with the Balfour Declaration, migration of people after World War II. Well, this isn't sounding very good for what Wilson wanted, other than the creation of some of these new nations we mentioned up there, those orange nations up there. Most of this is going in the direction of what the European powers wanted. And Wilson was willing to acquiesce on these regards. And the one he hated the most was the reparation payments and the full blame placed on Germany. He said that's just going to create all kinds of tensions and problems. But he felt that can be fixed. Many of these things can be fixed and mellowed out if we can salvage the 14th point, the General Association of Nations, or as it came to be called, the League of Nations. So the others agreed to it. The others agreed to create a tribunal, a League of Nations. And not real happy with what he had, Wilson returns to the United States with this treaty. I see one more line in here I may have already talked about. Did I mention the Ho Chi Minh story? I think I did, didn't I? I didn't? Okay. Well, here's another Versailles-related event. Ho Chi Minh, now surely that rings a bell. Close. Vietnamese leader, North Vietnamese leader. He was a patriot from way back before World War II. Ended up being president of North Vietnam until 69 when he died, throughout the early stages of the Vietnam War. He was probably the most central unifying feature of the communist movement in Vietnam for all those years. In 1919, he is a student in Paris from Vietnam, and he is also working part-time as a kitchen busboy. He hears of the 14 points in Woodrow Wilson, and believes that if he could get to Woodrow Wilson and say to him, we feel for what you're saying, we think you're sympathetic with our plight, that you should convince the French to release its control over Indochina. Because at that time, France had colonial control over what would come to be Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam. And so in the spirit of self-determination for estranged minorities, why not allow a separate Vietnam to exist? Well, he never got a chance to get to Wilson. He was thrown out violently of the Versailles Palace, told not to come back. And he took this to be an interpretation of how much Western white people feel about Asian people. And having already flirted with and listened to Marxists in China, he went ahead and followed their advice and went to Russia, to Moscow, which at this time is just now 2 years into its revolution. Became a committed Marxist, joined the Chinese Communist Party in the early 1920s. But then there was a period during World War II where he could have moved away from that. He fought the Japanese, and he made overtures to the Allies that if we fight the Japanese in Vietnam when the war is over, will you put the pressure on France to finally relinquish colonial control? And this is the time I'm mentioning where all these mandate colonies start to fall apart anyway, so he's thinking, wouldn't this be a choice time? Well, the French refuse, and from 1945 to, I guess, 54, the French continue to try to reassert control over Vietnam, finally losing a very big battle. This part's not on the test here. A big battle, Dien Bien Phu, and holding a Geneva Accord conference and leaving. creating a separate North and South Vietnam with Ho Chi Minh in charge of North Vietnam. And that could have been what steps away from what he wanted, and that was a unified nation because there were plans for an election. But then who steps in and fills the gap of the French? We do. And we back up the Southern government. And so what was supposed to be an election never came to be, and instead it turned into a civil war between forces in the South, aided by the North, by the Chinese, by the Russians, by ourselves. And so one could make the argument that had he not been thrown out of Versailles and talked to Wilson, he may not have gotten anything out of Wilson, but maybe just enough respect would have kept him from being so pro-Marxist. That's a lot of what-if history. But
yeah, he's still interested in that.
Yeah, I think
he has still been a
communist
either way.
It's hard to say. From my understanding is that his bitterness towards the West drove him quicker into the hands of the Russians. So since he showed himself in the 40s to have been a nationalist, that probably would have, he probably would have deserted the Chinese and Russians if we'd given him aid against the French back then. Yes, that's right. When the South lost in 75, they forcefully renamed it Ho Chi Minh City. So it's hard to know how much Marxism and nationalism, convenience, etc., figures into him. And it's like historians to try to draw a link to every event and claim, that's the simple essay to say Versailles is the cause of all the 20th century ails. But it is interesting how much connection there is in regards to the Middle East with Palestine and Israel and Vietnam, the start of World War II. And you can actually make a case for the start of World War II in two directions, both in Europe and in Asia, and the way Japan was allowed to continue to imperialize on China, because that wasn't fixed. Colonies in southern Africa went from German to British control, and then revolutionary Marxist movements in the 70s launched themselves in Namibia and Mozambique, etc., around the Mandate Colony situation. So there's just a lot of linkage there. And so in that respect, although he's a bit of a dreamy idealist, I think Woodrow Wilson had it pegged right to say that until we come up with foreign policy that is just and fair, you're just planting the seeds for future conflict. But he got and took what he could and brought it back home to the United States in item 34 and got ready for passage in the Senate. And when he comes back to the United States, he then finds another opposition, and that is in the form of the Republican Party. This is because in 1918, there was a midterm election. He'd been reelected in 1916, as you know, and his party had won control of both houses in 12 and held it in 1916. But in 1918, Democrats lost control of the Senate, and Republicans had not a large, but a majority. Why does that matter in our story here? Wilson's a Democrat, they're Republicans, but he's the president, so what does it matter? The Senate's in treaty ratification. Treaty ratification's in the Senate only. House can't help him out there. So if you were a president that was thinking ahead of the game here, what would have been a way to smooth over the feathers of the Republicans before you even ran into trouble?
Do something
political to feather their nests. One of the best ways would have been to take somebody prominent with him to Paris, which he did not do. He took one underling Republican, and the rest were all his vote. He didn't want to hear opposition. And the person who he should have been kissing up to the most was Henry Cabot Lodge, who we've talked about before. Lodge, at this point, had become the Senate Foreign Relations Committee chairperson as a result of those midterm elections. And Lodge personally disliked Wilson. There was bad blood between them. So it would have been to Wilson's advantage to take him along. If he couldn't stomach that, if he didn't want to have to share power, he should have held some meetings and said, please, Henry, tell me what you want. Tell me what's important. We can work together. Those kind of things would have gone over real well, but he didn't. Instead, he just came back and dumped it on the Senate and said, here, take it and like it. And when Republicans started to say, we'll debate which parts we want and change which parts we don't like, that's when he said, you can't do that. It's already a done deal. We've been through the negotiations. We've been through the compromises. There's nothing left to compromise on this. And this is the stubbornness that Wilson had. Well, Lodge headed up a group of Republicans known as reservationists. And I'm going to jump here from 34 down to 36 for a second, and I'll come back to 35. Republicans in the Senate actually should be broken into two camps, reservationists and irreconcilables. The greater numbers were the reservationists. And what this means was that Lodge looked at the Versailles Treaty as it came to him and said, most of it's doable, but there are some problems that we'd like to see changes be made. We have some reservations. So he sent around what was called a round robin note of changes for all to look at and all to comment on. So he was willing to go along with this if there were changes made. Or the other historical explanation of this is he really didn't want it to happen, so he proposed changes that he knew Wilson would never stomach, and therefore it would all die and be Wilson's fault. That camp comes from the belief that Republicans did not want to see a successful treaty get ratified because it would give such success to the Democrats they'd win the 20 presidential election. Now, maybe that's being cynical, but over the years, more and more, I've come to interpret the actions of parties, both parties, as how it'll affect the next election, and I think there's a lot of accuracy there. If not, it makes for an easy story to tell, so I tend to go that way. So I think there is something to be said that the Republicans were really trying to, sorry to use this word, submarine the peace process in order to destroy the 1920 election. Go off on a tangent that has no value to. In 1987, when we talked about this, the 1987 INF treaty that Reagan and Gorbachev negotiated for arms reductions, I remember watching that take place and I was such a Reagan hater that I thought to myself, he's going to get away with the Iran-Contra affair. He's going to negotiate this INF treaty. It's going to be wonderful and great. He's going to be praised for it. He's going to get the Nobel Peace Prize. Everybody forget what he did with Iran-Contra. Republicans will win the re-election in 1988. We got to submarine this treaty. And whoa, I thought, it's Versailles. Sorry. I'm willing to actually see the first reductions in nuclear arms be destroyed just for the sake of winning another election. I felt that come out of my own heart. So it made me easier to believe that that's what could have happened in 1918, 1919. So it's possible that Lodge's reservations were built on sincere concerns that if they were fixed, he would go for the treaty, or that he found reservations that he knew Wilson couldn't stomach, and that would wreck the process. And we'll talk about what those reservations are in a minute, in number 35. We'll come back to it. The other wing of the party, much smaller, which represented far west and midwestern states, was led by William Borah, called irreconcilables. These are people who just, no matter what, are not going to ratify this treaty. You can make all the changes you want with the League. It's a hopeless situation for us. We're not going to vote for it. And we can pretty well see why. A lot of it had to do with the harsh treatment of Germany. That wouldn't go over well with German-American voters in their home constituencies. But another reason, and this explains Midwestern isolationist attitudes towards the war and the peace afterward, was the belief that with all this focus and attention on war and then international commitments in the League, what's going to happen to progressive reform? It's going to be dumped by the wayside and forgotten. So a lot of these Westerners felt like the progressive movement has been derailed by first war and now commitment to the League of Nations. And that's why they were opposed to it. And there is some parallel to that in the 1960s. The belief by liberal Democrats that the Great Society War on Poverty of Johnson was derailed by Vietnam. And that could well be. So those two wings of Republicans are not, the one thing they are united on is they don't like the treaty and the League as it has come to them from Wilson. And 35 shows the points that Lodge was concerned with. It was Article 10 of the League Covenant. Before I read more about that, though, there's something in your textbook that I was looking at today I thought was an interesting statement. Lodge's attitude about Wilson. On an older text, it's on page 1017. I don't know if that's true for the current text. Let me read this to you. It says, Lodge harbored doubts. He did not wish the United States to withdraw from world affairs, but he felt that the outcome of Versailles exhibited the weakness in, quote, the beautiful scheme of making mankind virtuous by a statute or a written constitution. Let me repeat that again. He felt that the outcome of Versailles exhibited the weakness in the beautiful scheme of making mankind virtuous by a statute or a written constitution. What does that mean? Isn't that what we did with our Constitution?
Basically, just covered up everything.
Yeah.
And make everybody say, yeah, everything can.
Yeah. I think it's kind of this idea that if you come up with a scientific environmental influence, you can turn people from good to, or evil to good. This notion of manipulating the environment through an institution or through a scheme or through a document to bring the good out of people rather than the bad. Where did we talk about this before? Or am I just out of orbit on this thing? I saw the connection and got excited about it. Doesn't it sound like progressivism? If we come up with city manager system or commission form of government or recall election, direct primary, come up with the right system that the good will come out of people and the monopolists and the corrupt government will all go away. It's that idealism of progressivism put on the international stage. And then he follows with this comment. Americans, thought Lodge, were too prone to promise more than they could deliver when great principles entailed great sacrifices. Foreign policy would have to be built up from the public, would have to be built up from what the public would sustain rather than imposed from above. Does that sound like our current events? I'll read it one more time. Americans, thought Lodge, were too prone to promise more than they could deliver when great principles entailed great sacrifices. Foreign policy would have to be built up from what the public would sustain rather than imposed from the top down. So, of course, that's dealing with his criticism of Wilson's idealism. I think that's what I wanted. That's what got my attention was how much it seems so similar. And that these are the so-called lessons of history. And wasn't the leader of it one who had at one time been supportive of us to start with? So I see these parallels a lot. Of course, I look for them. I try to put tenuous connections together, whether or not there or not. But back to 35 here. This is what Lodge and his reservationists wanted. First, they were concerned about Article 10 of the League Covenant. Article 10 set up a system. It's a real interesting system here, where every nation would promise mutual collective security of every other nation. In this respect, that if a neighbor invaded a neighbor, they're not just fighting the neighbor, they're fighting everybody in the League of Nations. Did we talk about this before or not?
Didn't, okay.
So let's do some bad history and manipulate things all wrong to fit my point for a second. Let's say there is a Iraq and there is a Kuwait and there is a Saudi Arabia in 1921. None of that stuff happened until the 40s, but let's say in 1921 it existed. And the League of Nations existed. And we joined it. And every major power joined it. Saddam Hussein's alive, running the show in 1921. And he complains that the Kuwaitis are digging underneath the Iraqi border and drilling oil up that belongs to Iraq, which was true, they were. And so therefore, he says, we're going to invade and get the historic portion of Mesopotamia back into the empire. So he invades. If Article 10 of the League Covenant was in effect, what would be the follow-up? Nations or however many exist in 1921 would all attack Saddam Hussein and he'd be repelled. Even knowing that could happen, maybe you'd have to take one or two times to prove it, but knowing that could happen, what would he do?
I think it'd be a very effective way to prevent.
Yeah, he'd think twice about even starting. In fact, he'd say, gosh, we can't just take it by gun. I guess we'll just have to talk about it in the League of Nations through a dialogue. That was the theory of Article 10. Isn't that a great theory?
Yeah.
But idealistic Wilson said this can happen.
Just a second here. I'm having a... Okay.
Yeah, that was what the Article 10 said. So that if every nation promised to go to war on behalf of a victim nation, then it would create such an atmosphere of security that wars probably wouldn't break out any. Well, what's wrong with that in the mind of Henry Cabot Lodge? Yes, there's the key element. It commits us to a war before who has authorized it? Before Congress has declared it. Back when Congress used to declare wars, that was considered who had the authority to start them is Congress. Also, I read in your textbook about where after all the treaty votes failed, Congress passed a resolution ending the war. War was obviously over, but I thought, so it can be done. So Congress can undeclare war. I thought about that a lot. It would take away the authority of Congress to declare war. It would weaken the sovereignty of the United States. It would be, as many people have feared today, subjugating the U.S. government to the authority of a world government. So Lodge said we need to be able to have a choice on that. We need to be able to say, first our Congress votes whether to go to war or not, then we honor Article 10 if we join this thing. With Wilson said, you can't do that. If everybody could vote on it, then there's no security everybody's going to join, and that doesn't deter anyone from attack. So therefore, that defies the logic of collective security. The second concern or reservation that Lodge expressed was he wanted the Monroe Doctrine and Roosevelt Corollary to be exempt from the League. Now, we recall this. Collectively together, what does the Monroe Doctrine and Roosevelt Corollary provide for? Yeah, well said. Just the Western Hemisphere is a good answer. It's ours. Yeah, that's it. The United States would serve as the policeman, not some other nation coming in to collect on debts. If anybody's going to invade, that's our job. We collect protection money, that kind of thing. And so that's not at all in keeping with what the League Covenant would have wanted. So if we could get them to say, yes, we will agree, but we get to declare war first, but the Western Hemisphere is off limits, wouldn't that leave it possible for a Lloyd George Doctrine in which the Baltic Sea is under English control, or the Nicholas II Doctrine in which the Siberian Seas are under Russian control? I mean, everybody could carve out a sphere and say this is off limits of the League of Nations, and you have nothing for the League of Nations again. So those are the things that the Lodge wanted put in there, and that's why we say, were they sincerely concerns of American security, or were these the things that he knew could wreck the treaty? Kind of both. One thing for sure is he was speaking about what a majority of American people believed. Most Americans were far more concerned about having the right to declare war than being obligated to an international organization. And more people felt the Western Hemisphere was our so-called backyard or front yard to care for than leaving it to a European-based organization. That was where he was reading public opinion. Yeah. Sure. And this is still the time of dollar diplomacy. So say we had dispatched troops in Nicaragua and somebody interpreted that as an invasion and we're up against 120 countries. Yeah. That wouldn't go up so well. So yeah, I'd say really that Lodge was on the side of what a majority of Americans. While they were easily influenced, winning the war to make the world safe for democracy was exciting, and he was the president, Wilson was, but nonetheless, what Lodge was talking about probably was more heartfelt, so it was easy for him to make that case. So this is what is the fight over the League of Nations. Of course, Wilson's making statements that you can't make any changes at all, even if they're good changes, because we'd have to renegotiate the treaty with the Europeans, and they're not going to be willing, so you've got to take it as is. Well, I have down here that it was twice rejected in the Senate. Reading, I've realized that I forgot about there was actually three times in the Senate. So three times this treaty is taken through the Senate and rejected all three times. Before I get to the vote in the Senate, though, let me do 38, because 38 does precede 37 historically. When the treaty came to the Senate, Lodge used all kinds of delaying tactics, held special committee discussions on it, had the whole 1,000-page treaty, or however long it was, read word by word in the Senate, and delayed as long as possible. So as he was trying his best to derail and kill the enthusiasm for passing this treaty, Wilson decided, you've got to take it to the people. It'd be like if today Bush gets on television and makes a speech to everybody. We didn't have TV, so Wilson gets on the back of a train and travels out west where the people are the most resistant to this, making numerous stops, typing all day long and speaking all day long and not sleeping at night. His health was in bad shape already. By early fall of 1919, he collapses in Pueblo, Colorado. That's the end of the whistle stop tour, as it's called. But while he was speaking, he made some good strong points about if we don't ratify this treaty now, within 20 years, future sons of America will be dying in the trenches of Europe again, stopping a second world war, which turned out to be accurate. But once he collapses and comes back to the White House, I think by October and turning into November, he suffers a full stroke, and for nearly a year is pretty much out of touch with things. Other bills, domestic bills that need presidential signatures, come to the White House. Edith, his wife, takes it back into a closed room, brings it back with a signature that looks a lot like hers, not his. That's the government's conducted. There was one occasion where, when he was lucid and awake, Lodge and some others from the Senate came over and said, we'd like to speak with the President, and starts off by saying, Mr. President, we're all praying for you, praying for your help. And Wilson's response was, yeah, but which way? That's the relationship they had between them. Well, the treaty is dragged through the Senate three times. The first time it is brought through with the changes of the reservations that Lodge had in mind, much to the complaints and criticism of Wilson. And the lineup shows irreconcilables and Democrats together voting against it and the reservationists voting for it. It was an odd combination. So it loses. It doesn't even muster a majority. It's run through a second time in its original form as negotiated, and at that point in time, the Republican wings line up together, irreconcilables and the reservationists, and have a small, not even a full majority over that, so it fails. So then a third time it is run through in its original form, and this time the third time it runs through in the reservations again, so back to the changes, and Democrats jump ship, divide up, and join reservationists, and they still can't muster the two-thirds majority to pass it. So the bottom line for our test is, goes through three times, twice in a changed form, but is defeated each time. And there's Wilson with his health destroyed. But in his recovering state somewhat by 1920, Wilson thinks he has one more chance to make the League of Nations matter. And so what he claims is the 1920 election should become a plebiscite. The word plebiscite means like a national opinion poll election. We don't have plebiscites in America. We kind of do at the state level when we have referendum measures, but we don't have national referendums on issues, unless you consider the elections that. Pardon? A plebiscite is like at the local level, it'd be like a referendum. Like if we vote yes or no on tax policy, vote yes or no on gambling or stem cell research or something like that, that'd be a plebiscite. We don't do that on the national scale, unless you consider which party wins the presidency or a congressional election a reflection of. Like some people say the most recent midterm elections is a plebiscite on the war, that kind of thing. So that's what Wilson wanted to do. He wanted to make the 1920 presidential election center around the League of Nations. Well, it would supposedly send a signal to the Senate. If the people re-elect Democrats, they still want this treaty. That's not what the candidate James Cox wanted. Not at all. Cox wanted to be as far away from the League issue as possible because he knew it was a loser. Public opinion had put it behind them already, and the vote in the Senate didn't cost them any election or any votes in the upcoming election. So therefore, Cox wanted away from this, and he couldn't tell the president, leave us alone, because he's still the president, but he sure didn't want to identify with it. it hurt his election bid. He did lose to Harding, the Republican candidate. Now, here's somebody on the Democratic ticket that was for the League of Nations, his running mate, Cox's running mate. And who is that? Yeah, Franklin D. Roosevelt, a young Franklin D. Roosevelt, who had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy during the Wilson years, like his cousin Theodore had been. He runs for vice president. He doesn't win. But he is very, very moved by the whole fight of the League of Nations, so it's not surprising that FDR will have a chance to resurrect the ghost of Wilson where and when. At the end of World War II, through the creation of... Did we talk about that? Sorry I keep asking that. I just... My memory is so shot on that. If we didn't join the League of Nations out of the fear that Congress would lose its sovereignty and the authority to vote on war, why did we join the United Nations later? I know you're going to say, well, because Pearl Harbor woke us up that you can't be isolationist. Well, that's true, too. But what about the problem of losing sovereignty on war declaration? Wasn't that a concern, or were people just so willing to support FDR that was forgotten? Yes, it's the way it was written is the change. When FDR, studying how Wilson failed, set out to rebuild a league, rebuild it to the United Nations, and FDR will do this as early as 1941 August, before Pearl Harbor. He's already negotiating with Churchill for post-war plans. He's got put together, it's called the Atlantic Charter. They're almost like the 14 points reincarnated. He's got all these plans for, after we assist you in the war, we give you all these weapons and you win it, then we're going to rebuild the world based on the 14 points with the new league, the United Nations. And the way they built the United Nations to get around this problem we've just been addressing is the Security Council, which started out with 5 permanent members and has 15 now, 5 permanent and 10 temporary. Who were the 5 original permanent that still are in 1945? China, yeah. Why those 5? Because they're the winners. They're the good guys. So they get to be the permanent Security Council people. I can go for that. Whip Nazis, you get to be permanently on the Security Council. That's a good idea. So those 5, and then they've expanded it later to allow 10 rotating, so 15 altogether. The way it's set up is, if you get a majority vote for it, a military action can take place by those who wish to participate. But if even one power vetoes it, the whole thing's out. So the way it's set up now, if they wanted to do something that America doesn't feel appropriate, that we don't want to participate in, we can just abstain and not vote, and it can still go on, and we have no voice in it, or we could issue a veto and prevent it and stop it. I'm glad you brought that up. This is where the story gets really, really good. The war in Iraq is done by statutory authorization separate from the United Nations. It's the Gulf War with Father Bush is where this is really exciting. In January of 1991, the United Nations Security Council got together, discussed, voted, feared that China would reject, but they abstained, and they voted to authorize any nation that wanted to within the Security Council to go ahead and use military force to remove Saddam Hussein from Kuwait. So Bush got ready to start moving, and members of Congress said, wait, we haven't voted. You've got to vote to authorize whether you do this or not. To which Bush, the elder, said, no, you don't. I'm already authorized. Security Council just said we could. So it's the whole fight again. The Security Council is not the U.S. Congress. U.S. Congress authorizes war. Plus, there was that additional War Powers Act issue at play. And Bush made the statement, the vote's already been cast in 1945. When the Congress ratified entry into the United States, in the United Nations, that was the vote. So I don't need it. And they went ahead and voted anyway. Kerry voting against it, by the way. They went ahead and voted anyway. And within 5 votes, they approved Bush's support. Bush had made it clear, though, that if they had voted against him, he was going to go anyway. So the Bush family has a history of executive assertiveness in the face of Congress when it comes to war in the Middle East. What do you think would have happened if they had voted against his entry and he went anyway? Would they have impeached him? Not not when he wins, right? With the way the war turned out so victorious, he would have been considered the person that had the vision, and Congress would have been the surrender monkeys then, if that had been the case. Now, if it turned out bad, if it had been 10,000 body bags like Saddam Hussein was bragging, then it really would have been very detrimental to, in fact, that probably would have restricted presidential authority from that point on. But because the war turned out positive, I think he would have come up on top either way on that. In his last war, the son did seek congressional authorization. First he said, we have a UN resolution, which authorizes anyone. And then he said, he asked Congress for authorization, Congress authorized it.
But with the United Nations, France was so against it, then why didn't they veto?
Why didn't we or?
France, why didn't he say
that? Oh, why didn't they in the Security Council?
Yeah.
They were against it, but they were not wanting to go on record voting against it. They wanted to be verbally against it, but they didn't want to completely destroy the alliance. I mean, they're already getting called freedom fries, so they didn't want to have further risk.
What about Afghanistan?
The Afghan war was a separate earlier vote right after 9/11, and that was little opposition to that. 2002 October was the one for Iraq. So it's interesting how much, again, Versailles comes back to current events. So, but anyway, I got way off on that tangent because of FDR, who was the vice presidential running mate in 1920. He really wanted the League to survive. Of course, his top candidate, Cox, did not, so that's why he didn't make an issue of it. In that election, Harding and his running mate, Coolidge, who would be the next president, in giving a speech at one point, Harding, trying to capture this idea that we're tired of international commitment, we're tired of being involved in overseas wars, we want to get back to life as we knew it, a more simple domestic life in America, says we need to return to normalcy. Well, the campaign handlers shuddered at this because normalcy is not a word, was not a word at that time. It was like strategiary or dignitude. It was came off like that, and then they were concerned, we've got to get him off the campaign trail. He's going to derail himself with his language. But it turns out it was folksy, homesy, and caught on well. People loved it, and they let him go. And Harding was his best speechwriter, and he won because he really did capture the mood, returning to life as it was once believed to have been, not just before the League fight, not just before World War I, but even before progressivism. There's somewhere back in there this romantic ideal of the 1890s, or the gay 90s as it once called, with gazebos and simple life in the town square. Yeah, the Gilded Age, not all the corruption and monopoly, but just the kind of the simple life when we weren't involved in foreign wars and everybody economically grew. He successfully captured that emotion and got elected on it.
So what was different between the Gilded Age and the war?
Well, in one respect, the 20s is technologically far more advanced in regard to people, where they live and how they get to work and what's produced. So it's a modern age whether people like it or not, but there is a lot of parallels in race attitudes. There's parallels in not wanting to be committed in foreign policy affairs, unregulated economic growth. There's lots of parallels. So we'll go through the 20s and maybe we can ask that question again. Which is here in item one. Item one seems to be a repeat of 39. I think that's because at one point I transit out of World War I into the 20s that way. Look at number two here. Going back to our discussion of labor in World War I, we mentioned the fact that increased wages and maximum hours and safety standards were enforced by the government for those unions that produce war goods. But we also mentioned the fact that real wages dropped when inflation went up. But because of the no-strike pledge or the no-strike demand by government, they couldn't do anything about it. Now the war is over, and unions are thinking we're no longer obligated to a no-strike pledge. And the year of 1919 sees an outbreak of labor strikes across the country. Couple of them listed here in number three. Actually, four of them listed there. The real cause of these strikes is an effort by labor to get caught up on lost wages. But that's not how it's portrayed by government officials, business owners, and newspapers. What twist or spin did they put on this year of strikes in 1919? Yep. It's radicals. It's the Reds. It's the anarchists and the communists. Russians were talking. I mean, while they're trying to fend off our invasion in Russia, they're talking about that once they secure control of Russia, every working class member of Europe and America will follow suit. There'll be the international revolution will take place. So there is this belief that there are communist agents hiding in all the major industrial nations waiting to foment revolution, and this is to start in America. It's interesting to wonder to what degree did people really believe that, or was it a convenient way of saying you guys stop striking so we don't have to pay higher wages? But there is also at this time in 1919 to 1920 an outbreak of mail bombs sent around. Most of them sent from New York City, but they showed up in Georgia and Colorado, Chicago. Bombs sent in the mail, kind of like the, what was the stuff that was showing up in the mail? The white stuff? Yeah, the anthrax powder. It's like, where is that coming from? Everybody feared this is coming from terrorists. In a similar sense, these bombs were being mailed around. Most of them were mailed to government officials. No government officials were ever killed by them, but a maid for the governor of Georgia had her hands blown off when she got it out of the mail. So there was. It took for a long time to verify where these were coming from, but the belief is, what if this is part of the whole uprising of radicalism? Strikes that occurred are listed here in number three. The one that gets the most attention is the Boston police strike. September of 1919. Boston police, wishing for better conditions and higher wages, get nowhere with negotiations, and so they go on strike in mass. The governor of Massachusetts, Calvin Coolidge, is remembered for the quote, "Nobody has the right to strike the public safety anytime, any place." And he uses the National Guard in the state to patrol and monitor the city and fires all the police. This is such a success, you're remembering the Petco connection. This is such a success that Coolidge moves from just being a governor to becoming a well-known celebrity and is nominated for the vice presidential ticket in 20. So his response to the police strike makes him vice president. Ronald Reagan, when asked who was his favorite president, would often say Calvin Coolidge. And when asked why, he would say because Coolidge didn't stir up things that didn't need to be done. He let government run smoothly and business run itself and didn't interfere. Took naps and didn't stretch the powers of the presidency where they didn't belong. But many wonder if he also didn't admire Calvin Coolidge for his way he handled the police and the strike. What strike did in the very beginning of the Reagan years of 81 did he face? Air traffic controllers. PATCO, Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, was a union that voted for him, elected him, and before the election came in, they had signed a no-strike pledge also. But they felt after election, not getting any satisfaction from Reagan, they threatened to go on strike, and he says, "You do, I'll fire you all," and they went on strike, and he fired them all. Replaced them with military controllers for a while. So a lot of people say that he probably got this right from the way Coolidge handled the Boston police strike. In Seattle, a general strike occurred, which is so rare for America. I mean, it's common in European cities, but it's rarely ever seen in the United States, where people of different industries, people of non-related jobs, all go on strike in a day or a week's time. Show sympathy for someone. They all went on strike for city workers. But when you see people all going on strike from different walks of life, that just bespeaks of revolution, radicalism. It's got that European tinge to it. And so the mayor of Seattle, O.A. Hansen, says it's got to be the work of communists. There's no doubt to it. And so the again, the idea, whether it's in Boston on one side of the continent or whether it's over in Seattle, Reds must be at work stirring up these strikes. Steel strike in Gary, Indiana breaks out. I think he used it as an excuse, but I think it convinced others to fear it and believe it. He was trying to get order and control of the city. It reminds me of me. We got a few minutes here. Something I did back in 1981, which I guess I'm ashamed of. Mosley, Jack Mosley, used to be editor of the paper, was at a convention of his history teachers speaking. And this was right after the Reagan election. And he was commenting about how the Cuban situation was covered by the newspapers and how it ended up costing Carter re-election as well as Clinton re-election for governor. And I was the hot radical leftist in that time period, and so I stood up and asked him, I said, how do you respond to accusations that your newspaper planted lies about communists being in the camps in order just to hurt the Clinton and Carter administration's re-election bid? Stopped, looked at me, and goes, it's a damn lie. He started cheering the end. So I shouldn't have done all that, but it was rude. I kind of voiced it a little more, fly, like I said, do you feel it was unfair when people said? That could have been the way I said it.
It's not near as fun, though.
No, it wasn't. But that kind of speaks to the same idea. Was there a motive there within the Fort Smith paper to unseat Democrats in Arkansas, or were they just reporting things? So, like Hansen. United Mine Workers go on strike in Pennsylvania, led by John L. Lewis. This is the same union and same union leader that had been involved in the anthracite coal strike arrangement, working with John Mitchell. So there are serious concerns when there are strikes in many industries in different major cities across the country. As Ford suggests, people begin to associate this with the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia and begin to worry and fear if that is the start of a communist uprising in America. Well, it's a bit hard to believe when in truth the American Communist Party in 1919 had 20 card-carrying members. It doesn't mean there's not a lot of others, deeply hidden out somewhere, but when only 20 people will claim to be American communists, it doesn't seem like the country is that much in danger. But the Attorney General for Wilson feared them, A. Mitchell Palmer, or wanted to better his own situation like Coolidge did. So A. Mitchell Palmer says, as Attorney General, it's my job to find out where all these Reds may be hiding, and most likely, where do you start looking for communists? Labor unions? And in the community, where are the communists all at right now? Russia and Eastern Europe, right? Eastern European immigrants in America are probably the ones we're talking about. So he launches the famed Palmer raids, as they're called. Police raids through major cities in the Northeast, investigating whether or not immigrants from Eastern Europe and Russia are communists. Many are rounded up, many that are actually naturalized citizens, rounded up and deported back to Russia, back to Poland. Never any proof or linkage. But they were Arabs, so that was good enough. I mean, they were Eastern Europeans, so that was on purpose. And is working on the mood, and it made Palmer a big name. He himself didn't conduct the raids. He stayed in his office, instead sent J. Edgar Hoover to do the work for him. And J. Edgar Hoover did such a wonderful job of flushing out radicals and Reds that he was in 1924 made head of the newly created Federal Bureau of Investigation, where he remained head of the FBI until 1972. And because we're running out of time, we can't tell a bunch of Hoover stories, but there are lots of wild J. Edgar Hoover stories to tell. So when we return, we'll be on number 5.